welcome to Not So Different, a podcast from the Center for Biosimilars. I'm your host, Assistant Editor Skylar Jeremias. A major barrier to biosimilar adoption is physician hesitancy when it comes to prescribing these agents, especially in the oncology space. Physicians often want more clinical or real-world evidence on the safety and efficacy of biosimilars compared with reference products in patients with cancer, for whom the stakes are high when choosing a therapeutic or supportive agent. Additionally, some clinicians worry about having to stock multiple biosimilars for a single reference product. These may require different storage conditions and increase the risk of administering the wrong agent, creating financial risk for the practice. We sat down with Dr. Gary Lyman, an oncologist, hematologist, public health researcher, and longtime biosimilar advocate who has also helped develop guidelines in support of using biosimilars in the oncology space. We discussed what steps are needed to improve physician confidence in using biosimilars. So, Dr. Lyman, to start us off, what needs to be done to address physician concerns over having to stock multiple biosimilars for one reference product?
Yeah, I think this is primarily in small solo practices or small group practices that handle their own pharmacies, their own prescribing, treatment on site. It's perhaps less concerned to oncologists, like in the setting I'm in, a large cancer center or university, large health system. Where it's really the pharmacist that's challenged to find space to stock all of these, particularly if the patients you serve are covered by a range of insurers, as in our region. So you have to anticipate each insurer will probably have their own preferred version of each of the biologic categories and biosimilars. When you have a mix of patients being seen, even on a single day, covered by a mix of payers, you have to stock the agents that will be compensated and can be used in this range of patients. So it is a concern. Again, I think the smaller the practice, the bigger the concern, both in terms of their capacity to do that. But in terms of it, it comes right down to the clinician themselves or a small team of clinicians who are paying to stock all of these in anticipating needing them on a day-by-day basis. As I think, again, less of an issue for large health systems with multiple providers, large multi-provider practices. Where it's really just the pharmacy needing to find space and catalog all these agents. So it is complex. It is a challenge. I don't see an obvious solution to this as long as we have a free market and a payer system as we do, we're going to obviously, due to contractual relationships with industry, payers and health systems are going to vary in terms of what their preferred agent is in order to keep costs to a minimum. So it's, I think, a problem that will have to be solved at a much higher pay grade than mine.
Now, some experts believe that there is an overwhelming amount of evidence to support the use of biosimilars, but some physicians still believe that there isn't enough. What's missing from current bodies of evidence that could convince physicians to choose biosimilars?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, one of the things we do is an effort to be sure all clinicians are fully educated as to the regulatory process, why all this emphasis on preclinical data has reassured so much of us that with some much more limited clinical data, we can say unequivocally that these are highly similar and likely to have no meaningful difference in terms of safety, potency, efficacy to the original biologic. I think the way I approach this with my colleagues who might be maybe we view as biosimilar skeptics in today's terminology, is to point out, again, the extensive review process that these agents go through in preparation for any clinical evaluation. There are more than 60 critical quality attributes as of now that these agents go through to compare the biosimilar to the reference product, and they have to demonstrate that they are virtually identical within fairly tight margins of similarity with each of these quality attributes. A far more sophisticated preclinical process than was available 10 years ago and certainly 20 years ago when these biologic reference products were originally approved by the FDA. So we've really gone orders of magnitude up in terms of the technical ability to compare these agents and ensure that they are just about as similar as one can imagine them being. The other point I make is that the reference biosimilar, whether it's trastuzumab, bevacizumab, rituximab, or the supportive care growth factors on the shelf in the pharmacy today, is not exactly the same agent, not exactly the same molecule as was approved again 10, 15, 20 years ago. Due to drift because of changing in manufacturing facilities, changing in product components to these agents, these are agents, these molecules produced in living systems, in cells, and they're inherently going to be variation in these products over time due to any change in the production, manufacturing, packaging, and so forth over time. And it's, of course, industry and FDA's requirement to make sure at any time there's a change in the process that there's a validation or confirmation that it has not impacted on critical aspects of the molecule that would affect safety and efficacy. So there is this ongoing need for monitoring, for surveillance of these agents over time. But that is just as essential for the original biologics, which have changed over time, as it is for a new biosimilar. And I would argue, in many ways, I can be far more comfortable that a biosimilar that's gone through all of these, you know, highly technical and sophisticated quality attribution evaluations than it would necessarily be of a reference product that was approved many years ago. So this isn't going to convince everybody, but I think in my experience, when a clinician understands how sophisticated the process has been, how there's no reason to think that a biosimilar on the shelf today is any less safe and effective than a reference biologic on the shelf today, which has changed since its originator was approved, that we really are on very safe ground saying these can be used and the clinician can choose any of these and be comfortable. He's not compromising a patient's safety and efficacy. That's not to say for any biologic therapy or any drug, if you are concerned about an adverse event or a patient not doing that well, that you shouldn't report it. Pharmacovigilance for all drugs, and particularly biologic agents of all natures, is critical to the process. And it's essential that we are the providers, whether it's physicians, pharmacists, nurses, clearly report any concerns that they have, and that can be investigated. But there's no reason to think that those concerns should be any more serious for biosimilars than they are for biologics in general.
What are some ways to ensure that physicians have better access to evidence supporting use of biosimilars so that they can make informed prescribing decisions?
We've encouraged industry to publish all of their preclinical and clinical trial data. You know, all these come with some comparative clinical data including pharmacokinetic, pharmacodynamic studies, immunogenicity studies, and then some comparative efficacy and safety studies for the original indication that has been sought for a biosimilar. I think where I hear concerns from clinicians is this somewhat novel term of extrapolation. That is where an original biologic, every time they've sought a new indication, either for a different disease setting, a different cancer altogether, have needed to conduct and report clinical trials, comparative clinical trials, to see, show that the biologic works and is safe in that new indication. The decision was made by the FDA, and I think most of us in the field very much support it, that if you required the same of all the biosimilars, then you'd lose the advantage of perhaps making these agents available at a lesser development and approval cost and a lower price once they're on the market. So the decision was made that if a biosimilar has demonstrated to everybody's satisfaction it's safe and effective for an initial indication, and in addition, the manufacturers provided evidence that would indicate that patients that might receive it for a different indication, again, either a different stage of disease, a different disease entirely, would not differ significantly from the original patient population for which approval was granted, that the FDA has the prerogative to grant extrapolation, a label for these other indications without necessarily requiring additional clinical data, clinical trial data. So for instance, the original growth factors that were actually the very first, biosimilar G-CSF approved in the U.S. is not technically a biosimilar because it was approved before the FDA regulations, regulatory approval process was in place. So they sought approval as an originator. So it's considered a different drug, and they got approval just for the one indication for preventing febrile neutropenia. Subsequent biosimilar versions of G-CSF, whether it's filgrastim or pegfilgrastim, went through the biosimilar regulatory approval process, and the FDA has the capacity and the authority for a drug approved officially as a biosimilar to grant extrapolated indications for the all the other label indications that the originator filgrastim and pegfilgrastim were given when they were approved. So these agents are used in stem cell transplant patients and in other disease settings, because they provided large clinical trial results in these other indications, but because the FDA deemed, based on the evidence provided, that these would be just as effective there in these other indications as the originator G-CSF agents were and are. So again, the FDA has the authority, but it's not an automatic thing. In other words, the manufacturer needs to provide the FDA with not only the evidence for the initial indication that supports that and grants approval as a biosimilar, but additional evidence to support their conjecture that used in these other situations, there would be no reason to think the patients would suffer more side effects or be less effectively treated with the biosimilar than they are with the original biologic. So that still raises some concerns. Clinicians like to see clinical trial data. We're so used to that. Our whole field, our whole discipline has been based on drugs approved by that more traditional process. And that's certainly sometimes still comes up in discussions. But I think our thrust at this point is to make sure everybody at least understands all the rationale, all the basic background and the regulatory approval process, and that all the major professional oncology organizations, including ASCO, NCCN, ESMO, and so forth, have looked at all this and integrated biosimilar forms of cancer therapies into guidelines and said these can be used with equal anticipation of safety and efficacy. So, after all of that, and of course, clinicians have to take time to be educated in all this, and most will understand why this is not only means they're keeping their patients safe and offering them safe and effective therapy, but hopefully they're contributing to this effort to rein in healthcare costs, which in and of itself becomes a barrier for patients and health systems sometimes to provide access to these highly effective and sometimes curative therapies for our patients.
Well, Dr. Lyman, thank you for sharing your insights with us. And thank you to our listeners for tuning into this episode of Not So Different. You can find additional information in the show notes. And until next time, you can visit us at centerforbiosimilars.com.